And then a hurricane blew through that island and destroyed everything. I mean, it was a violent, horrific hurricane. And people had everything, you know, blown away into the ocean. I mean, people died, people drowned. It was horrific. And after the hurricane, of course, everyone is in shock, right? And they're trying to rebuild from nothing. Everything had been destroyed and blown up and blown away. And a series of poetic essays start to appear in the local newspaper on this little island. And these essays are capturing the grief and the sorrow, the fear, the anxiety, the anger of the people who just went through this terrible hurricane. And everyone's reading these essays and they're loving them. They're like, this expresses how I feel. This captured, they loved it. And it was all written under a pen name, a pseudonym. No, nobody knew who the author was. And so right there was all this buzz and gossip about who actually wrote these. And guess who it was? A young boy, 16 years old, named, yeah, you got it, Alexander Hamilton. And that's when the people of this little West Indies island, they come together voluntarily. They say, you know what? This Hamilton kid, man, he's bright. He's talented. He needs to get out of here. He needs to go somewhere where he can study with real teachers. And they put together a collection, and people contribute funds, and they purchase a ticket to send Alexander Hamilton, young Hamilton, off to New York in British North America. And that's how Hamilton arrives in New York. He's either at the end of his 16th year or 17 years old when he arrives in New York. And he goes on, right, to, from that kind of humble beginning, he goes on to, he's the right-hand man of George Washington. I mean, think of what that means. It's very arguable that Washington might not have had the success he had in the Revolutionary War if it wasn't for Hamilton. That Washington might not have had the successes he had in his administrations as president of the United States if it wasn't for Hamilton. Hamilton is there with him the entire way through. And he's fascinating because he's this young man of, he has so much energy. I often like to describe Hamilton as one of those rare souls who has the energy of 10 people packed into the body of one person, right? Nobody could keep up with Hamilton. When someone else would write an essay on a subject, Hamilton would respond with 10 essays or 15 essays. Where someone else might write 5 pages, Hamilton would write a 150-page treatise. Right? And I mean, think of the homework. Someone who wanted to respond to one of Hamilton's lengthy treatises, they had to go spend weeks or months just doing research to figure out what Hamilton was talking about. And by then, Hamilton had moved on, would be, you know, writing other things on other subjects. When he's young, when he got to New York, he was there when the first British warships were sailing up the East River next to Manhattan. And that's where he was going to school, King's College, which later became Columbia. And Hamilton hated it. And you know what he did? He went and stole a cannon from the British, and he's shooting at British warships sailing up the East River. I mean, think of how many 17-year-olds you know who would, you know, go start shooting at his own government. And that kind of feisty energy that was both a virtue and a vice. I mean, there were moments where it was great to have Hamilton with that kind of energy. And, you know, then there are these moments in his life, these scenes in his life where he's getting into fist fights on the streets of New York. I mean, it's just ridiculous. He wasn't very good at self-discipline. He was brilliant and he was energetic. He did not excel very much in the whole, you know, self-control, self-restraint kind of category. And You know, there's one other piece about Hamilton that's I want to mention before we move on. And that's his view of slavery. Hamilton, that little island in the West Indies, it was a port for British slave ships. He saw this all the time. It was a routine thing. Slave ships would come in, and sometimes they would unload or load some of the slaves, and so he would see these slave men and women and children in chains, and he hated it. That image of those human beings being dragged and forced in chains, shackles around their wrists, around their ankles. He despised that with every fiber of his being, hated it for his whole life. And when he got to the United States, Hamilton helped to create one of the very first colonization societies. This was an organization whose purpose was to help manumit slaves, to free slaves, and then send them somewhere where they could live peacefully on their own. You know, away from their former masters, or, you know, where there all kinds of bad things were likely to happen. That was Hamilton. At the same time, he was helping to, you know, helping George Washington win a Revolutionary War and be the first president and all those sorts of things. And he was Treasury of the Secretary, all those things. And he was thinking about how to start in motion the process to get rid of slavery, legalize slavery in the United States. And I'm convinced that had he lived longer, he would have been one of, if not the preeminent, anti-slave mover and shaker in the United States. But he didn't live long, because Aaron Burr put an end to his life. And I think when Burr shot and killed and murdered Hamilton, I think we lost one of the great anti-slave forces in the early United States. But you see how my point here about Hamilton, and I could keep going on and on about Hamilton, and I won't. I just want to say that it's important that he's the one behind the Federalist Papers. I don't know anyone else who had the combination of learning and genius and talent and energy to tackle a project as big as creating the authoritative explanation and marketing campaign for the United States Constitution. Hamilton's the guy. Hamilton's the one who has to do this, and he does. And so there's, we owe something to Hamilton for that, a debt. There was a question that came up at our Vino and Veritas meeting that I think I'll repeat here. And the question is, what about the anti-federalists? You know, there were people highly critical of the proposed Constitution. And here's what I said in our meeting last Monday night. That certainly is true. In fact, critics of the Constitution started to question and challenge the Constitution before the convention was even finished. There were several people who left the convention and started, you know, writing in public about what was going on in the convention. They didn't trust it. They didn't like it. And I reminded people the spirit, the intention of the critics of the Constitution, this group of writers and speakers who later become called anti-federalists, they were opposed to the proposed Constitution. They were writing from a background of freedom. Their entire orientation, the source of all their concerns, all their worries, flowed from a love for freedom. They loved freedom. They loved independence. And their worry was that this proposed Constitution would lead to a government that would be too centralized, too powerful, too controlling, and freedom would suffer as a result. It's sort of interesting when you look around what has happened to government today in the United States. I mean, those concerns about the anti-federalists, they certainly were not far off the mark. They certainly were not crazy, right? One can say that. In the context of the Federalist Papers, the Federalist Papers did not create the debate around the Constitution, the proposed Constitution. That debate was already happening. So Hamilton and Jay and Madison, they enter a debate that is already going on. And if you have the time, if you have the wherewithal to read the Anti-Federalists, as you read the Federalists, there's no better way. That is the optimal way. That's the best thing. It's also time consuming. So it's really, you know, it's up to you. How much time do you have? How much energy do you have? I will say this about the Federalist Papers, for the most part, with some few exceptions, for the most part, the Federalist Papers presents the arguments, the criticisms, the challenges, the questions of the opponents to the Constitution. The Federalist Papers repeats those things very often. You know, they'll say this writer, Brutus or Cato or the Federal Farmer, whichever anti-Federalist out there has published the latest pamphlet or article in a newspaper. You see those arguments reprinted in the Federalist, and then the Federalist Papers will respond to that. And I think for the most part, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay do a pretty honest job of restating the concerns, the criticisms, the arguments of the anti-Federalists. So it's not a terrible thing just to read the Federalist Papers alone. It's better. It is better if you can read the anti-Federalists at the same time, because it's a debate. And so, you know, I mean, imagine if there was a live debate and you had a transcription of it and you only read the comments of one person, right? I mean, to really understand the debate, you would want to read both sides. Same thing here. So it's really a function of time and energy and dedication on your part. What about this pen name? They choose a pen name, a pseudonym. They don't sign the Federalist Papers themselves. There is no Federalist Papers signed John Jay or James Madison or Alexander Hamilton. They're all signed Publius. Who was this Publius? Well, Publius was, his full name was Publius Valerius Publicola. And he was a famous Roman statesman. We know about Publius from several sources. Among them is Livy's famous history of Rome. He writes about Publius in there. Also, Plutarch in his Lives, where Plutarch contrasts a famous Greek. Every chapter is a famous Greek and a famous Roman in sort of similar situations. You know, compare and contrast them. And there's a chapter in there on Publius. He's the Roman figure, and the Greek figure is Solon. Why do this? Well, when the Anti-Federalists, in fact, let me back up here just a second, because I keep throwing these terms around yet that we haven't defined yet. The word federal, it's sort of, it is a credit to Hamilton's marketing genius, what he does with the word federal or federalist. The word federal used to mean, you know, like a confederation, a federal or federated system meant a system of multiple organizations or governments together in some kind of confederation, right? Where there's limited agreements of working together. Think of the United Nations today, right? Nations belong to the United Nations, but the United Nations isn't really a government. It's just an organization. It's a place. It's a confederation of sovereign states, sovereign nations. And what Hamilton does is he adopts that word federal or federated was universally popular among Americans, among revolutionaries. They didn't want a centralized power. They certainly didn't want a centralized national power. They wanted a confederation, a federal system, a federated system. So what does Hamilton do? He starts to use the word federalist as a synonym for national. The national government, he starts to refer to it as the federal government. And we still do today, right? Most people today, most Americans today, when they're going to refer to the national government in Washington, D.C., they refer to the federal government. And that really is a legacy of Hamilton. I mean, in a way, if you really got technical about the word, it doesn't make much sense, right? There's national and then there are either state or local governments. But to say the federal government, right? I mean, it really should be a reference to the federated system or the confederation. But he starts using it as a synonym for national. The national government is the federal government, and the national constitution, the proposed national constitution, is the federal constitution. Therefore, anyone who's opposed, what title are they left with? They're the anti-federalists. And that's how the critics, the opponents of the Constitution, come to be known as the anti-federalists, because Hamilton latches onto this word federal or federalists and waves it as the banner. We are the federalists. We are for this Constitution. So any opponent has to be anti-federalists. And any of you who know anything about marketing know it's generally not a very good marketing strategy to present yourself as anti anything, right? It just sounds like someone who's whining or complaining. I'm against this. I'm against that. And Hamilton wants to say, hey, look, we have something. We have a constitution. May not be perfect, but we have something. What do you others have? And what they have is that they're the anti-federalists. They have complaints. They have criticisms. They're whining and they're complaining, but they don't have a new proposed constitution. So that's how we get the federals versus the anti-federalists. And those anti-federalist writers, the very first ones, they started adopting names like Cato and Brutus. And who were these people? Well, these were people who were prominent at the fall, at the end of the Roman Empire. Remember, Brutus helps in the assassination plot against Caesar. And so it's at the very end of the Roman Republic. So these anti-federalists, you see, their strategy is to use names like Cato and Brutus and suggest this short-lived experiment in republicanism, small r, republican self-government here in the United States. It's at an end. We're at the end. If we adopt this constitution, we are at the end of republican government in the United States. Well, here comes Hamilton then. How does Hamilton answer that? He chooses the name Publius. Publius Valerius Publicola, who was one of the founders of the Roman Republic. Publius lived 500 years before Brutus and Cato. You see Hamilton's, what he is trying to project, the idea he's trying to plant in the minds of Americans is, this isn't the end of the American Republic. This is the beginning. This is just the beginning. We have centuries to look forward to of great Republican government if only we adopt this Constitution. So the anti-federalists are saying Republican self-government is at an end, and along comes Hamilton and says, no, it's just beginning. And that's sort of a sign, right, of how hard it was to go up against Alexander Hamilton in public and political things. He was always outmaneuvering, outflanking, outthinking, outstrategizing his opponents. Now, all this Roman stuff, these Roman names, what's the deal with that? What's up with that? Well, here's what's up with that. Remember, prior to the American Revolution, there was a grand global war, the French Indian War, which was the English Empire, the British Empire, against its main rival, its main foe, the French Empire. And both of these were global empires. They both had colonies all around the world. And it truly was the first world war, in the sense that the French Indian War featured battles all around the globe. And the English emerged from that victorious, right? They won, and at great cost. That's why the English start looking around at their own colony, saying, boy, we need some money. We need some revenue for the government. This war has been really expensive. You know, we've been building navies and supplying armies and everything. We need some money in our coffers. Let's start taxing our colonies. And especially look at those colonies over there in North America. They're incredibly productive. They make things and sell things and trade things. Let's start taxing them. That's where the whole fight over taxation begins. And that will culminate, of course, in the famous cry, no taxation without representation. Okay. Well, there's another problem for the English Empire. Not only were they broke after the French Indian War, but they had a very practical problem on their hand, and that is they now found themselves in possession of a global empire, a gigantic global empire. This is where the phrase first emerged that the sun never sets on the English Empire. This is true. I mean, the English had colonies all around the earth, and so the sun really never did set on the English Empire. And the practical question was, how do you administer? How do you run a gigantic, far-flung empire that stretches around the entire earth? How do you do that? And part of the answer was, well, let's look at examples of great big empires. Do we have some examples of really large, far-flung empires? Why, yes, we do. The most prominent, the most well-known, the Roman Empire. And so in the 1760s and 1770s, that whole period there, we saw a flurry of studies and histories about Rome. Scholars writing on Rome. This became one of the most prominent themes because people wanted to know, English wanted to know, how did the Romans run their empire? What can we learn? Can we learn from their successes and their mistakes? Most famously, some of you might recall Edward Gibbons. He wrote a very prominent, big multi-volume history of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. So the point is, Rome, ancient Rome, would have been quite familiar to the Americans of 1780s. Because they're surrounded by references to Rome, books about Rome. Everybody's talking about Rome. And that's why they're using these Roman pseudonyms and all these references to Rome. It's why the Americans, some Americans today, they hear that word Publius and they think it sounds kind of corny or cheesy. But the Americans of 1780s, they knew who Publius was. And Publius was a hero. Publius helped to vanquish the last of the Tarquin kings and transform the ancient Roman monarchy into the Roman Republic. Publius helped to create and expand the Senate and, an instrument of republican self-government rather than monarchy or tyranny. And so that name Publius would have meant something to the Americans of that time period. I mentioned very briefly on Monday night the structure of the book, and I'm not going to say much here in this podcast. We're already running a little bit long. I will say for those of you, I have recommended highly that you get the Signet Classics edition. This is the one. It's edited by Clinton Rossiter and Charles Kessler. Kessler was actually one of my teachers in graduate school. So this is a little nod of respect to Professor Kessler. And up front, Kessler has a very nice introductory essay. And in the course of that essay, you'll see just a few pages in, he provides a nice diagram of the structure of the whole book. So I'm just going to point my listeners right now to that introduction, to that structure, that outline there of part one and part two of the Federalist Papers. What I wanted to say here in conclusion as we wrap up this special Vino and Veritas edition of a Speakeasy podcast is I wanted to offer a couple of comments about, suggestions really, for how to read the Federalist Papers. There is There's an ancient way of writing with which the founders were very familiar. Some people call it subtle writing. Some people call it esoteric writing or hidden writing. And it's not really a great mystery. It's as simple as you communicate in different ways for different audiences, right? All of us do. You do, I do, everybody does. You speak, for example, you speak to a small child differently than you would to an adult. You speak to a friend differently than to an enemy. You speak to someone you know well differently than to someone you just met, right? I mean, you're always taking into account of the situation and the relationship with your audience, and you will adjust properly how you communicate, what you say or what you write. Well, the authors of the Federalist Papers were like that too. And so sometimes they have some things to say. They want to speak some truths. They want to write some truths. And they know that the Americans might bristle at those truths. They might not want to accept them. They might push back. And so the difficult truths that the authors of the Federalist Papers push back, they're going to present them in ways that are surrounded by language and ideas that make their audience happy. So, you know, I'll just give you a couple of examples here. For example, every time that the authors of the Federalist Papers are going to be critical of the Americans, and this is especially true in the second half of the book, in the later part of the book, where they're pointing out all the mistakes the Americans have made in their own state constitutions. They've really screwed up. They've really made some bad mistakes, and it's led to some bad consequences. Bad things are happening in the United States, not the least of which was Shays' Rebellion, which was some farmers who they were not upholding contracts. They were not paying off their own debt. And when they were going to possibly lose their farms, they marched into a courthouse and ran a judge out at the barrel of a gun. That's what's happening in the United States. That's what those kinds of things, like Shays' Rebellion, is what led to the call for the Constitutional Convention. And when the authors of the Federalist Papers want to point out some of the mistakes the Americans have made, they will first preface it with all kinds of flattery and praise. They'll say, oh, you Americans, you're so virtuous, you're so wise, you're so noble. And then, oh, and by the way, here's this stupid thing you did, and here's this other thing, and here's an instance where you were gullible. The structure of the book as a whole, I think you'll start to notice, for example, that in this, I said just a moment ago, there's a long history of this kind of hidden or esoteric writing. My teacher's teacher, Leo Strauss, my teacher was Harry Jaffa out in Claremont, California, and Harry Jaffa was a student of Leo Strauss, and Strauss wrote an entire book about this called Persecution and the Art of Writing. That is paying close attention when authors present lists, for example. Look at what's first, look at what's last, look at what's in the middle. Look and see if an author says one thing and then immediately later contradicts himself. Is that contradiction because the author's too stupid, too thoughtless to realize he just contradicted himself? Or could that contradiction be purposeful? Could there be a reason for putting that contradiction in there, in the Federalist Papers? Here's a little example of careful reading of an esoteric text. The word demagogue appears twice. There are 85 papers in the Federalist, and the word demagogue appears only twice. And it's really curious where it appears. It appears in number 1, and it appears in number 85. That's right. The very first and the very last papers. That's it. The word demagogue never appears anywhere else. Now, I look at that. And this is just a tip. This is a suggestion. Feel free to ignore this if you think this is not valuable. I look at that And I think, you know, Hamilton and Madison, these are clever guys. I don't think that's an accident that the word demagogue appears in the very first and the very last page. That seems to be sending a message. The entire book of the Federalist Papers is an attempt to teach people how to live as free, self-governing, constitutional citizens, citizens of a constitutional republic, and take ownership of that and be in charge of their own lives and their own property to a large extent. And what is that teaching literally surrounded by? The problem of demagoguery. All human beings, including Americans, right, living in a constitutional republic, all human beings are always prone to be tempted by demagogues, by someone who shows up and flatters them, tells them they're great, promises things that the demagogue cannot possibly deliver, right? Promise impossible things. And what happens very often with demagogues? They get others to follow. Sometimes they become great tyrants. And so I look at that and I think, you know, there's a message there. The Federalist Papers seems to be saying that freedom within a constitutional republic is literally surrounded by the problem of demagoguery. There will always be demagogues attempting to divert the attention of free citizens away from their own interests and trick them, flatter them, bribe them into supporting the demagogue himself. And so all of this is to say, as you start your journey through the Federalist Papers, and as we go about discussing it, be patient. Be patient. When you read a passage that you really like or you really dislike, don't be so quick to make a judgment about it. I'll give you another brief example. Right near the beginning, in number 2, the very second paper, which is one of the papers written by John Jay, it celebrates the homogeneity of the American people. All these similar, you know, all the Americans speak the same language and they have the same religion and they have the same cultural background. And isn't this is a great strength? This is a good thing. This is a virtue for the American people. And a lot of commentators today, well, communitarians and other types will quote that and say, see how important it is to have this common language and common background. It's even celebrated in the Federalist Papers. Yes, it is. And within 3-4 papers later, Publius is describing these scenes of how Americans are going to turn on each other. And it's going to be bloody and violent and civil war. And so, you know, he starts saying, oh, it's great. You have all this stuff in common, you Americans, and, you know, this all these similarities. And yet, just a few papers later, that all goes by the wayside. And the emphasis is on how these Americans are at the verge of, you know, slaughtering each other. So all of this is to say, be patient. The Federalist Papers are presented to us. We're the readers. We're the audience. We are Americans. We're the readers. We want to learn. And it is presented, that book is presented to us, not as the work of 3 separate authors. There's not one section with John Jay essays and one section with James Madison essays and one section with Hamilton essays. It is presented to us in book form as the product of one writer, one mind named Publius. And so let us read it that way. It comes from one mind. And when we see an argument, and then later we see a counter argument or a contradictory argument or a change in the theme or the thesis, let's ask why. What's going on with Publius? Why has Publius seemed to be saying something different now than he was saying earlier in the book? That's what I mean when I suggest be slow about it. Be patient. There's a lot going on in this book. This is one of these books that you really do want to go back to over and over again. You cannot read the Federalist Papers too many times. I promise you, every time you return to the Federalist Papers, whether it's the second time, the 10th time, the 20th time that you open it up and start to read it again, you'll see insights that you didn't see before. It doesn't mean you're going to agree with everything. It means it's going to enlarge your view of the world. It's going to deepen your understanding of this book. You're going to see from a higher perspective, a higher horizon. And so don't be too quick to expect all the answers to come in the, you know, the first paragraph or the first number or the first section. Let's work this through this together over the course of this year. And by January, when we're toasting each other there, you know, just before Christmas and New Year's, we'll reflect on how far we've come working our way through this whole book, and times where we thought we understood what was going on, and then there was this big surprise, Publius, you know, changed terms on us. And what does all this mean? What does it mean for us as free citizens? What does it mean for we, the people of the United States, who ultimately are the owners of the Constitution? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you for those who showed up last Monday to the first meeting of Vino and Veritas. Thank you to those of you who were unable to make it or who just didn't have a seat because we actually sold out. We couldn't accommodate everyone, which is a great problem to have. But you have managed to get into the second meeting, the February meeting. Thank you for your patience with us and your perseverance. We really appreciate it. I look forward to seeing all of you in February at our second meeting of Vino and Veritas. Have a great rest of your day or evening, whatever it happens to be. Thank you.